This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Sol Daniela. My guest today is the lovely and amazing Trina Bardusco. I asked Trina to talk with me about my upcoming book, View for Death, which drops on May 17th on Amazon. And I'm delighted to have her for episode 100.
So first of all, congratulations on writing a book, especially about such a painful experience that's so alive in you. It takes a lot of courage. And also because I feel like there's a lot of people out there who are suffering in silence about caregiving, and they're not exactly sure what to do. They feel very alone. So that's very generous of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and before we get into all the details of this book where you go really deep into detail, which I really appreciate, let's start with love.
Okay.
Let's start with love. So because a caregiver's journey is fueled by the deepest love imaginable, really. So who was Dan Larson? Let's start with that. And then I want to get into what you write in your book about meeting him. And you said something that's so beautiful. You knew him. Yeah. So who was Dan?
Dan was a great man. He was a feminist. He was a champion of women, a journalist, a Columbia Journalism School alumnus, Danish, super smart, resourceful.
You told me his first wife was
also Puerto Rican. Yeah.
Puerto Rican. He has good taste, this man.
I think he does, yeah.
So he's Scandinavo, they know what they're doing, huh?
He would say, I'm colonized. It's a joke, but it was so funny. He had a good sense of humor. And I thought it was so, I think about it often still, the fact that this Danish man from Copenhagen married two Puerto Ricanas. How does that, you know, like that's so curious.
Well, I have no doubt why. But before you continue, I know that, I had met him too personally at your wedding. It was such an honor to be there. Such a beautiful wedding.
Yeah.
And you also said that he traveled the world also for his work.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about him being a journalist. And
he started as a journalist, really young. And that was his career. And he had many experiences from, you know, TV producer, news producer, and then later he went independent, and he focused his journalism on the developing world and covering, you know, all kinds of strife and pain and war, and he was very knowledgeable about world affairs and how things interconnected. He dedicated a long period of his work to radio. I think it was Bog Radio, and he did work in Central America. I miss his commentary in this present landscape, and not only locally but just globally, because he saw a lot of what's happening now coming, and I think it has to do with the fact that he was so knowledgeable of how countries are more connected than disconnected, and how their policies affect one another in this global world that we live in. So that wisdom of his is something that I miss terribly. And I know his friends miss it terribly as well. All of us that knew him, you know, we always like, contra, ¿qué diría Dan ahora mismo? I wish I had that, you know, that voice to hear him. Someone that had a lot of concern for humanity, you know, a big, big heart, a beautiful heart.
Would you say that that's what attracted you to him, this person who could show you the world and also have a big heart? But maybe we should rewind.
Yeah, that brings me to your first question, that, you know, how I knew him. I first met him when I visited Denmark in the early 90s. My sister was living there, doing a year abroad, and I went to visit her. And Dan's daughter Solana and Sabina met in Denmark, and when I went to visit, I stayed at their house.
Solana, Sabina, Soldanela.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I walked in, and you know, this is over 20 years ago. This is the early 90s. And I remember walking in and seeing him, and he was absolutely beautiful. You met him when he was much older. But let me tell you, that man, when he was at the peak in his 40s, he was just parecía un movie star. He was just, it was just like, I was like, oh my God. And I remember shaking his hand. And just something took a hold of me. It was like, I knew him. I can't explain it. I'll never be able to explain it, other than it was something inside me that was like, I know this man. So, you know, life goes on. And throughout the years, I would, you know, I would ask Solana, you know, how's your father? But, you know, never imagining ever in my wildest dreams that I would meet him again.
And how was that?
So, again, when I met him, again, like, 20 years later, I was again like, he was so nice, and we just ended up started talking, and that first evening, he asked me, you know, I was preparing to leave, and he asked me, you know, can I pull your hair? And that's what I thought. I was like, I've never had a man ask me that. And I've had a lot of different lines on me, but that one was like, I've never heard this. I was sort of impressed with his self-assuredness, you know?
Did you let him?
I did. And then I guess the rest is history. Nothing happened, but I, you know, I did. I said, yeah, of course, you can pull my hair. And we had a little discussion about it. And then he said, you know, we should talk more. And there's a lot to talk about. He was very interested in all the different things I did. And I kind of confided that I was a little lost. I didn't know if I was headed in the right direction. And Dan was really good about advice. He's very practical, methodical. No, you know, if you know how sometimes women, we are like, ay, Dios mío, I don't know. He'd be like, wait. Stop that. Let's get back on track. Well, let's go back to the matter. You know, very, you know, he made you think about things in a sensible way. And we just started having these really great conversations.
How long were you married before he passed?
Just 18 months, because he was diagnosed 6 months after we married. And then the rest, you know, the next 11 months, he passed away 11 months later. So it was really sad. So altogether, we were together like 4 years and a half.
And you said to me before we started this about how in a way, not his passing, but how he, in a way, saved your lives, had pointed you in the right direction, even while he's no longer here.
Yeah.
You want to tell me about that again?
Yeah. One time, we were, one of the loveliest days I've ever had in my life, we were in Berlin, sort of a family day, you know, Mauer Park, you know, we were in the market, and dinner, and lunch, and we ended up in this cafe. It was kind of late-ish, drinking some whiskey and just talking or whatever. And we had such a great day, and all of a sudden I just started to cry. And Dan was like, pero mujer, you know, we were so happy, and all of a sudden you're crying. And I said to him, you know, I'm a lost artist. I don't know where my artistry is. You know, I don't know what to do. And he's like, okay, let's break it down. Let's go through it. What was your first art? And I said, well, dance. He's like, okay, do you want to dance again? And we went through everything. We went through all of the disciplines that I've had experience in the arts.
Which have been a lot, by the way. We could get into those accolades. I know it's dancing. You've also been a publicist. You've written before. You have a journalistic streak to you.
You've choreographed.
You've choreographed. I mean,
yeah. So it's been quite extensive.
Yeah, so we know that about you.
So the conversation was really interesting, and we didn't. Nothing came of it, in the sense that, you know, there wasn't a resolution to it. But it did make me. It made me think. Mm-hmm. And it was around those days that one morning he said, "You know, I should train you in radio. I think you would like that medium." I was like, "Yeah, I would love that actually." But it never happened. So obviously, you know, he passed away, and I was that first year, you know, that, you know, Joan Didion, that title, you know, the year of magical thinking, you know, that first year is sort of, you're in this kind of state of here but not. And it definitely took me a good 18 months to get out of the funk, to get out of this really deep, buried sense of not knowing how to really live. And then one morning, I was actively looking for things, researching people that were doing life projects, you know, people that had started from nothing, you know, looking for inspiration. I was active. I was sad, absolutely, and down and fallen. But I was active also looking to see what I could do, what I could hold on to sprint, you know? And I was writing. I was already at that point. The book had been written, but I was sort of looking through all of this year of writing and reviewing everything that I had written. And one morning I wake up and I follow Paul Jarvis, who's an entrepreneur, a programmer, really interesting person. And he was one of those people that had really interesting things to say about being a freelancer, about being a creative, about being an entrepreneur and a creative spirit and person, and how to like focus your, you know, ideas and how to make something of them. And one morning I wake up and there's this email that says podcast challenge. And for some reason, I held on to that, and I felt it was Dan somehow, like, that's it. This is modern radio. Go for it. And I've never dreamt with him. I've never really seen him. But I felt that it was him in some way speaking to me from the beyond, saying, hold on to that. And in that split second, I realized that I wanted to have conversations with people, because I know all these amazing people, all these creative people, and that would be a way to heal, to hear people out. How do they, why are they creatives? Why do they do what they do? Why do they fight for what they do? And I went for it, and that's how Notes from a Native Daughter started, right? And that's why I wanted to, and I held on to that for dear life, and that's why I do it, you know. And every week, I committed to that. I also learned that from Paul's podcast challenge class. I had three takeaways from it. The first one was just start. The second one, commit. You pick a day and commit to it. Commit to it. Because if this is something you haven't done, you're going to have to get used to a rhythm of bringing this, incorporating it into your life. And then pick a topic. Pick what you're going to talk about. So that I had. And then the commitment part of it was like, okay, so I'm going to stick to Sundays. It's sort of like a good day in the week where I know that for the most part, I won't have things to do. I'll pick that day. And I picked Sundays. And then I started, and I was looking for you know, they said, you know, you're gonna evolve as you go. You can't expect yourself to be, you know, Terry Gross in episode one. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to go through the motions, the experience. You have to do it. And so that the great quote, you know, you don't have to be great to start, but you do have to be, you do have to start to be great.
And persevere. This sounds like you got some very sensible advice on how to be sensible.
Exactly.
To begin with.
And I think Dan would agree.
And this brings me to, first of all, it's very brave to use your pain to move forward with, it's kind of like you take everything you've got and like, okay, what do I got? Let me push forward with what I have, and this is my way to overcome. I don't think the sadness ever goes away. We've spoken about that because I've had my own situations, but I can't help hearing, you know, si del cielo te caen limones, aprende a hacer limonada, you know? Yeah. And I guess the English translation isn't so great.
Yeah.
But
lemonade, I mean, lemonade. Beyonce writes
lemonade.
About
no,
that.
No, you're yeah. right, lemonade, yeah, lemonade. Yeah, yeah. So we've got the lemonade, right? Does it feel good, the idea to go around with a baseball bat beating stuff up? Were you angry?
No.
No, that's interesting.
I understand the question, but I don't know that I'm angry.
You don't feel
it.
Like a victim
no,
of life?
No. No.
Because I think it's very easy to do that. It's like, why I got married.
No.
Very few months later, this happens. And I think that you...
It's a sad thing. It's a sad affair. It's a sad circumstance. But I don't feel like a victim. I
have so much love. I'm going to take this up a notch. In my woo-woo world that I like to inhabit. So you wrote, you knew Dan, but do you believe in past lives, and do you believe that the way we die is also fate? And in your experience, was there a knowing there too? Now, I may be jumping ahead. We could start with the book, but I think that having read the book, it wakes up these kind of it evokes in me these deeper questions, right? And I don't know if you want to leave that question to the end, because I do want to talk about the book now, but it made me think about all those things.
Well, it's a good question. It's a fair question. I don't know if I'll give too much away.
Okay. Well, for those of you listening, you don't go there, but these
you're very perceptive. I appreciate that. You know, I think... I believe in so many things, you know, because I think that life is so mysterious. Maybe there are past lives. Maybe there are parallel universes. I think of the connections, how I connect with people. When I knew Dan, it's not the first time that it happened. I've had four different circumstance where I feel like I have either time traveled, right? And we think of time travel. We get into a machine and we go to 1876. No, I don't know that that is possible, but I think the spirit, I think ourselves in the spirit of us can feel time. And I feel that people, we are connected, you know, we are connected to people. And so I'm very sensitive about that, you know, when I, you know, with you, like, I remember meeting you and Alberto and we became instant friends.
Yeah.
And sometimes that happens. And so what is that about? Do we know each other from some other time?
Yeah, it's almost like you don't even need that much of self-explaining who you are or make even the slightest effort to be understood by another person.
Yeah.
Big theme in the book is the pain because of the pain, right? Meaning your pain in seeing him suffering, right? And this is the ode to the caregiver part, which you make very clear to the book that, hey, you know, we really need to think about caregiving, and we'll get to that, but, and caregivers, right? And so the theme of the pain because of the pain, so your pain in seeing Dan suffering, and you reveal details with the simplicity almost of a haiku, terrible details that you somehow elevated through the kind of simplicity that needs no explanation, because this book is not dense to read. It goes fast in a good way. It has photos in it. It's almost like something that you want to read if you're going through this as well and have it be, wow, a shared experience. But the details are sometimes the things that you choose to put in are pretty terrible and detailed. So what was your process in distilling the language just so, going from what I'm sure was this huge experience and then just taking it to the minimum of what we needed to know?
I started writing in what I would consider was the hardest night of my life. And it was a moment in time when I was desperate. I was desperate. And I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown. And I don't know what came over me. I don't know what it was. But something made me calm myself down and guided me to think outside myself. Watching him suffer was terrible for all of us, you know, for his children, for his friends, for his family. It's just terrible. And I didn't want to fall into the victim. I didn't want to fall there. And I felt myself almost just falling, right? And it was that moment that I closed my eyes and I remember. And I was like, think of something that is sadder than this, worse than this. And I thought of all the women out there in the world, like, going through that, who are alone. And I know that men are going through this too and are alone. But my condition of being a woman and our menstrual cycle, it makes us more vulnerable to so many other things, you understand? I can't shake that. There is so much pain in this world. And there's so many women that are so lonely and so desperate. And I started to write. I don't know that I was thinking I'm going to write it this way or I'm going to write it that way, or I'm going to make it simple. I was just writing. And I wrote for 365 days every day. And again, like I said before, it wasn't until on day 366, that's when I knew I had to now go back and review this book. And actually, that was an advice that Joan Collins, the writer, gave in this wonderful magazine called Apology that Jesse Pearson puts out whenever he can. And I love the magazine. And they gave Joan Collins this amazing expose. You know, she's sort of an underdog, even though she sold millions and millions of copies of books around the world. And her advice was, you know, write every day. Every day, if you write, after a year, you're going to have a book. And I loved it. I loved that. And in that moment, that night, she came to me. And I was like, well, I'm going to write. And I'm going to write every day. And that's what I did. And on day 366, I went back and started reading everything I had written of that year. And so I started a self-editing process. So I had all that there.
Because the book is only how many pages long?
Without the pictures, it's about 17 pages.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost an ode to this person. It's so crystal clear. It's such a wonderful read. And at the same time, the words that you choose are all we really need to see this picture. I don't know why it just comes out so clear. It must have been I feel the energy behind it. I feel the eagerness to get it out, the sense of these feelings of desperation. There's another theme that I find multi-layered, right? So you are Puerto Ricanian, New Yorker, in Denmark, in a hospital there. You are alone in this book. You don't have your family there. So you are a stranger in a strange land, alone with this man you love that you committed to. And I want to hear about the experience of being there as opposed to be somewhere else, or what maybe their perceptions of death could be different than us as Latinos or Americans, but also being estranged from death until you really have it in front of you. And I think that's why the view of death, right? Y el título en español, que es lindísimo, que es
Paisaje para la Muerte.
Paisaje para la Muerte, right? So we always think that we're looking somewhere else, right? Where we're strangers to this, but really it can come quite close. So
yeah,
what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have this profound love for Denmark. I miss going there. I haven't been able to go back since I went back in November of 2015 to pick up my stuff. They were really good to me. Everybody there, or at least I felt they were. They let me be, you know, like there was this one night I would go into the nurse's station all the time and ask for things. And one night one of his daughters came who is a nurse. And she saw me go in and she's like, "You can't go in there." And I'm like, "Why?" She's like, "Look, it says no." And I was like, "Well, it's in Danish. I don't know what it says."
Qué metida.
But I didn't know. But what I thought, what endeared me, even at that moment, was that the nurses, I guess they understood, you know, that I wasn't from there, that I didn't know all of the signs, even though I ended up being able to understand or read some Danish because there are Latin words that, you know, that are equal to all, you know, onkologisk, you know, so you know it's oncology. Sometimes there was one night I was kind of scared, you know, that I was so sad because I knew that he was going to die and I was alone. But I wasn't alone. Dan's family was amazing to me. They were amazing. They were there. And they were there, you know. They were there. We were all there, all of us. It was like a tribe. And then two of my dear, dear friends came. Dena from Spain and my friend Anna Boysen. I wasn't alone.
I want to go back just to the style of the book, too, because you do write about a Viking nurse who came mm-hmm. to help you.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a play, right? So you say the nurse, the daughter, the good woman, and you have this style going on. But then also you don't get into the details of what was really happening to Dan in terms of what was his diagnosis and all those things. And I kind of appreciated it because you were distilling really what is often underlooked, right, which is this, the pain, because of the pain. It's yeah. something that people hide away and they don't know how to deal with. And why should I be feeling pain if they're in so much pain? And I did a documentary last year called Cada Paso el Camino for AARP. And caregivers, they just really, they need help too.
Oh, yeah.
And so I felt that in you revealing this very, I don't mean to say distilled in a way that's simplistic or that undervalues the literary aspect to this, but you really did do this stylistically, and I'm wondering what was the reason for that too.
So, editing this book was really—I put a lot of work into it. And at one point, I realized that I wanted to make it anonymous. I didn't want to give names. I didn't want to give what the disease was. It was colon cancer, because that is beside the point, right? It could be Alzheimer's. The disease doesn't matter. Of course it matters to the patients. Of course it matters to the family. But ultimately for the caregiver, the experience of the strain of caring is beside the point. What is real and what is the pain of seeing someone you love wither away, and then of how you deal with your life.
La impotencia, no?
Right.
La impotencia.
The impotence. I wanted this book to be some, you know, when you see someone crying and you want to touch them, but you don't dare to because you don't know if they're going to be like, "Leave me alone," or they're just going to cry, or they're going to run away. Because for me, this is really about other people. Another woman could read this, right? That I felt the anonymity also out of respect for the other people that, you know, I didn't want to assume what his children were feeling or his brothers were feeling. I can only relate what I was feeling. And so I had to shave off a lot.
There's something that you bring up that's very chilling in the book where you say, okay, here I am in Denmark with universal healthcare, with the 24-hour treatment that everybody's entitled to, and this is still miserable. So you bring it up, and I think it's towards the end of the book about, and I think it's your ending, what about us? What about us in Latin America and the U.S. where, ¿qué va a pasar con nosotros, no? And I know you wrote a little bit about that. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's really the my call to action or my protest and grievance. I think it's a grave disgrace that this country that professes exceptionalism, we don't offer universal health care. It is our birthright. We all are made the same way. We stink in the same places. We will die the same way, different circumstances. But life is life. And all this jargon of preconditions and no conditions and healthy, I mean, it's like a reduction of humanity.
Absolutely.
And I was in Denmark, it made me aware because while it was a really sad situation, we didn't have to worry. I didn't have to worry about so many things. We didn't have to pay for this treatment. We would just go to the pharmacy that was connected to the profile of the patient who knew exactly the medicines that they needed. None of this referral shit. You don't have to go pay thing. You don't have to go. It just the differences are so big. When you go with someone to radiology or chemotherapy, that you don't have to worry about the Medicaid that it covers, that it doesn't cover. Make sure you call your doctor. We can't take care of you right now because the referral hasn't come in. And meanwhile, your person's there like in agony. It just seemed completely disgusting.
It seems grim, our future, at so many levels, but also that you have to, it's morbid, really, that you have to save so that you die okay.
That's if you die okay.
If you die okay.
Because we all, you know, the presumption is that we all have an even life, and then at the end you die, all, you know, but life has all kinds of left, you know, curveballs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how long, you could be in agony for a long time, you could be, but the fact that we have to think in terms of ourselves getting sick and needing to have a plan for that is really
it's atrocious.
On the soul. It's very hard on the soul, and people who have children and this and that, and you're thinking, oh my God, my parents, and for especially our age, right, middle-aged people, that you're thinking, wow, you know, well, I don't have kids. I know you don't either, but you're bringing up children, and then at the same time, your parents, and you know, it's like this sandwich. I mean, I think you yourself can become sick, right? So, do you think we're understanding what it means to be a caregiver? Do you think we have any preparation for this at all? And do you think sharing your experience will actually shed some light on this?
I hope the experience does shed some light on this. I would love to talk wherever anybody wants to talk about this. I don't think there is any safety net or structure to support caregivers or families, or just the entire medical structure is not set up for that, to help anyone, really. Just enough. To help us, just enough. We have great doctors, sure. We have great nurses. The nurses are heroes. But the structure that holds that together, which is a commerce. If there was a universal structure, then maybe these mothers that are caring for a kid that's really sick, without having to worry about where they're going to have to pay for this care, you know, that is a big, humongous relief. I don't think we understand. I don't think people understand how immense that is. It is every time that I went with Dan to do a treatment, to get the blood, to do the fact that we didn't have to go through this whole, like, give me your insurance and da-da-da-da, I'm still stunned. I'm still like, wow. And, you know, just this very January, my mother, because of Hurricane Maria, came. She was very, very sick. She was basically in the hospital for the whole month and January. And man, it was cumbersome.
I want to just say one more thing about that and then go back to some things in the book. But you write this in, you know, your afterword is almost as compelling, because it's more like an essay, right? And I think it's, in my experience, what I'm seeing is that in having done this documentary about caregivers is that people really need support. And you said, if you're handed a slow death, also pray for the ones that will care for you. Might be a wife, husband, daughter, son, sister, brother, cousin, aunt, uncle, a friend. Their life, too, will be uprooted without mercy. At best, and in the best conditions, you and she or he had the time to talk and say it all. That was my case.
Yeah.
Do you think we do enough talking about how we're going to say goodbye?
No, I don't. You know, I can't speak for everyone, but for the most part, I feel people are very afraid to say goodbye or to confront tragedy, their whole entire lives with someone, if it's a wife or a father. I thought about that because between me and Dan, we had such a good relationship. You know, it was so young, We had a transcontinental relationship. It was very cosmopolitan, very cool, very open. And, you know, there wasn't any, we didn't cheat on each other. We didn't have a lot of...
No había maraña.
No había, yeah, we didn't have all the
vicio,
stuff.
No, yeah, yeah.
What we did talk about was, and he sort of prepared me about what to do once he died. And again...
Before he got sick.
No, when he got
sick.
When
he got sick, right.
Because he had... He himself had been a caretaker. And he was very clear. You know, he was always like, you know, you're going to keep your apartment in New York and you're going to keep your job because when I die, you have to go back to your life. And he was so right, you know, because a lot of people were like, well, close your apartment and move. And I was like, and he was like, don't. You need your house. You're going to need that place when I'm gone. And you're going to be responsible with your employer and you're going to be honest with them. And you're going to say, I have to leave right now because of these reasons. And you're going to be responsible with everyone around you that you work with because you're going to have to go back to that life.
Well, that's very sensible. But I know that I've seen, especially in the Latino community through this work that I did producing this documentary, is that people... They're not having those conversations.
Right.
They're giving everything they have, all the money they have. They're not thinking of the future. They're not talking about it. They're not understanding the diagnose in its entirety and things like that because of
denial.
There's
two different issues.
Dial. So
there's two different issues.
How to be sensible, how to talk about this. It's taboo, really. There's a big taboo.
But there's two different issues. There's the issue of people giving everything they have to care because they love, because they care. And they're going to give everything they can because they want to know that they did everything they can. That's a system that has not protected us as citizens, right? That's a system that's not protecting us, precisely. People are spending their dimes. People are going into
everything,
debt.
Everything, everything.
People are spending their homes to help. That doesn't happen in Denmark. You don't have to worry about that. So you can give of yourself without having to give up your house. We have having to go into debt. That's a big relief. So perhaps if just that alone was not there, yeah, if someone is dealing with, mira, I got to pay for the chemo. I got to pay for this other treatment. I got to pay for this other treatment. Mira, but I'm going to die. I can't talk about that now. I got to save your life. There's two different things working against each
that
other.
That don't help. One does
that
not
don't
help,
help
the
because they have to survive. Here you have to fight to survive. You have to fight to stay alive. You have to fight for your job. You have to fight to get that laundry. You have to fight to get back to that hotel. You have to fight that bill. You don't have time to talk about death. because you have to make this work.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the reason why we're so beat and we're so distracted by toda la sinvergüenzura of this business of...
So a quiet space to really confront, you know, death and how we're... It is a different conversation. And overall, I don't care if you're Latino, Black, white, what, it doesn't matter. We are all afraid to say goodbye. And that takes time. Perhaps if this can help people not be so afraid, that would be amazing. But it's so important to say goodbye, especially if someone's dying slowly. You know, maybe it's 3 years, so you talk for 3 years about dying. That's okay.
I oftentimes hear people say, I'm not afraid of death.
Oh.
I'm afraid of
illness
or the pain of dying, right? And I think that obviously we do have a big question mark over our heads, like, what is death? Where are we going, right? But that's a mystery.
Yeah.
But what about this fear that we have of the illness and the pain? Is there a way to look at it in the eye? Like, is there, can we prepare for this?
You know, I don't know. No, you can't. You don't know when it's going to hit. You don't know.
Should we be thinking about it? Or talking about
what I would say is, you know, acknowledging pain is a really important of finding resiliency to carry on, to live, right? Because life is so hard. It's wonderful and beautiful, but it can be so disheartening. And we're so afraid to look at our pain. And sometimes we have to look at it. We have to face it. We have to eat it. It's important because it's the only way to overcome it. Sort of like if you're drowning and you have to come up for air and you have to swim really hard to the top. You have to swim and you have to do it like that. I don't think life offers us any other way. When we turn from it and we pretend everything's okay and we just go on and we lose a part of our humanity, I feel like, to be able to connect and empathize with other people.
Yeah, it's almost like you're going to crash a little harder if you do it that way, if denial and putting things off. And it reminds me of Eckhart Tolle. He speaks about in order to get out, you have to go in. And that's such a deep thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you've done with this book is clearly in order to get out of this depth of
sadness.
Despair, you came in and you actually, thankfully, you're creative and you were able to bring something and bring it to the rest of us. But I think everybody can have the power to do that. And I think key is also the not feeling like a victim. I admire you for that because, and we fascinate, you know, why me? And I think that if you're a caregiver in a way and you go there, how are you helping the other person too, right? And I have seen some of that as well. And so it's good to be strong.
But, you know, I don't judge that. I understand why people would, men or women would sometimes feel like a victim, especially here. Because if you're poor and you're caregiving and you have nothing and you're working and or you can't give them the right care, I can understand why someone would feel like a victim. And in many ways, they are. And so that's why, this book is an offering. It's a gesture for that very reason, you know, because I think we are, unfortunately, very cruel with our own society when it comes to healthcare.
Did you ever think that you were going to be a caregiver?
Never. No.
Do you know that in Spanish there's no word for it?
Yes. I watched your documentary and I agree with what, you know, the first man was saying, you know, cuidadores, bueno, pues, you know, in the work of the translating the book into Spanish, I you know, I was like, sí, no hay una palabra como caregiver.
Is it just assumed that that's going to take place, or it's just fascinating to me that in a culture it's so caring,
yeah,
there isn't actually a word for the person that
Gives the care,
yeah.
Cuidador, cuidadora.
Cuidador, they're using it, yeah.
Guardián. Aprendí de
yeah.
You know, I learned that from
the
work.
Bueno, we say el ángel guardián.
El ángel guardián.
That's maybe our magic realist
version
of caregiving.
Exactly, that's a good spin.
El ángel guardián.
Yeah, yeah.
El ángel guardián. Hoy es tu tía el ángel guardián, mañana es tu amigo. Exacto. So that's...
And sometimes it takes a village, and that was my case.
You know. Do you think he was ready to die?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why?
Well, because when you can't be self-sufficient and you've been a being of industry, whether you're a man or a woman, that's not life. That's not a life for the person that's sick and for the caregivers, you know? A life is a life. I mean, it's a life, but it's not a life when you can't do anything for yourself, especially in an adult man that has lived 67 years of flying the world, of talking to people from all over the world.
But don't we naturally lose a lot of our faculties and in life in general? I mean,
sure, but it's a different thing to lose life to an illness that's impeding you to live. In any way, shape, or form, in dignity.
What about spiritually? Do you think he had completed his path? I mean, what do we say about people in terms of, there's a beautiful quote by Wayne Dyer, who I know you're a big fan of.
I love him.
Yeah, and Wayne Dyer says, did that person sing their song? You know, did their soul, was their soul able to sing the song? I hope I'm quoting it correctly, but...
Yeah, man, Dan was fierce.
He logró cantar tener su ritmo,
yeah,
su melodía,
yeah,
la expresó.
Yeah.
Does that give you comfort?
Yeah, it does. He was a very honorable man. And he did so many things. He lived a full life in every single way. He loved, he traveled, he wrote, and he was brave, you know, and but he was very aware that he was dying, and especially towards the end, it was very sad, you know. He didn't want to be like that, and I don't know what happens when you're dying. I don't know what happens. I don't know what it is. I don't know what, you know, where we go or where that other part of us goes. But he was very brave till the very end.
Do you want to share some of his last words that he had for you in terms of how you could keep on living without him?
Don't be a lost artist. That's what he said. And
we're not lost.
No.
We're just finding our way.
Yeah.
But as a multidisciplinarian artist myself, I understand the sentiment and how wonderful to have some,
yeah.
We all come to things differently in life, right?
Yeah.
How long ago did he die? You said that there's a, the date is coming up.
The date, it comes this coming Tuesday, mm-hmm. April 17th. It'll be 3 years. So I'm really glad that, I wish the book would have been ready sooner, but a lot of things happened. You know, when you're doing a self-produced project, it's never a straight line, right?
Nothing is ever a straight line.
Yeah. So, but I think it's sort of poetic that it's, you know, it's this three-year cycle. It's like a triangle, right? It has three corners. And there's a balance. And then I get to announce it and push it on the eve of this third-year anniversary.
And in English.
And in Spanish.
And in Spanish. And through your podcast, mm-hmm. Notes of a Native Daughter, that how many episodes have you done already?
This is 100.
With me?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What an honor. So that's such a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea if they're here with us or not, perhaps, but I think he would be very proud of you, for sure.
I think so.
Y que esa energía de amor no te la quita nadie, ni lo bailado, nada.
Exacto. I'm relieved. I'm happy. I think I'm going to cheer with champagne, you know, I don't know, at the end of May when I sell at least one copy.
No, and I highly recommend the book. I've read it really fast, and and that's why I'm honored that you chose me. This was an eye-opening experience this past year I had, and then coming and reading your book and just seeing that it shouldn't be a morose topic. It shouldn't be sad. I didn't feel like your book was sad at all. I just felt like it was, like you said, a view of death, a window into something that we can look at and say, you know, déjame pensar en esto un poco sin miedo. Let me think about this without being fear, and the kindness and the kind of nurturing in the people that I love start this kind of nurturing dialogue about their wishes or certain things that you don't want to find yourself in a hurry later to talk about, right?
Exactly. You want to talk about it when you have your five senses, if you can, as best as you can, you know?
One of the saddest things I've seen is the high, el alto índice de Alzheimer disease everywhere, but especially among Latinos, because there's a connection now between diabetes and Alzheimer. So,
wow.
Cuidado con el azúcar.
Okay.
Todos. But imagine that, you know, like you, there's so many ways that you can go and losing your ability to express yourself, and you don't want to be guessing. And if you're somebody who's also sick, you're responsible to make sure that everybody knows what you want and to be aware.
Yeah.
You know, it goes both ways because caregivers, they have a lot on their shoulders, you know.
They do.
Pretending that nothing is wrong, nor, you know.
But it is a noble effort.
Oh, yes.
And it will bring solace. If anyone's listening and you're going through this situation, talk. It will help, especially when the day comes. You will have those conversations inside you, in your heart. You can reconcile things that maybe you otherwise won't be able to ever, you know? And I think we're all worth it to give ourselves that chance, if you have that chance. Because when people die suddenly and they leave families with unanswered questions, that is just also heartbreaking, right? So if you have the chance, talk.
Sounds like something Dan would say.
Yeah.
Where can we find the book?
I'm going through Amazon. Mm-hmm. They offer the best package really for self-publishers. I mean, there are other ways, but for my budget, you know, I had my budget, but then Maria came and wiped it away for all kinds of other reasons. So I had to redesign myself as to what I was going to do. So it drops the 17th on Amazon, and it'll be there exclusively for 3 months. And then it'll go.
En español también.
En los dos idiomas.
I recommend buying it and giving it to other people as well, because people who are in it are the ones who could most benefit from this. And they're not the ones who are going to be hanging around in Amazon chilling out. I mean, because I have some friends right now who basically I just show up to the hospital with ponqué or, you know, they don't sleep, they don't eat. But if you give them a book that they can read or something like that, de que sea como el tuyo, bien poético, bien, I highly recommend it.
And the other thing is that in perpetuity, 50% of the proceeds of the book is for a fund. And I'm going to give money to women caregivers that are in dire straits. I already know a few. And offer them some relief with either they can choose, you know, groceries, menstrual kits, paying their phone bill. And it might be that I can help with all of those things, you know, let's see how it goes. But that's the intention. And laundry service. That's the other thing that is a big deal, especially if you're going through a lot and you have kids or a mother. And then after a full day or a week, you have to do laundry.
Mm-hmm.
It's cruel. So if I can help somebody with laundry, I'm good. You know, like it's a little gesture. I can't help somebody's life, but maybe we can alleviate a little bit of all of the things that are the responsibility of a sole caretaker.
And give some hope to the people, because whenever you do gestures like that, or you say, hey, I feel you, I connect you, I know what you're going through, it's like energy, you know, sparks of love and fuel for to keep going. And I also, urges me also to really take seriously our healthcare system. We can't take for granted that anything is going to be handed to us in this country. And we have to start thinking about this seriously.
Yeah. I say single payer.
Ha! I'm with you.
Thank you, Trina.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you for writing this book.
Thank you.
And for doing this podcast.